Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. This is Lori Smetanka with National Long-Term Care Ombudsman Resource Center. I am going to be facilitating this afternoon's webinar. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. We're going to be talking about the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program proposed regulations this afternoon, which were published in the Federal Register on June 18th. The whole Ombudsman Network, I think, was very excited about having these regulations published in June, and I know that many of you have been working your way through them and are interested in hearing more about what the intent from the Administration on Aging was as they wrote the different provisions. So we'll be talking about that today. All lines will be muted during today's presentation. We will have time for questions and answers at the end. You will be able to ask a question either by typing it into the chat box in the lower left corner of your screen, or by clicking on the feature to raise your hand, which is also on the left side of your screen, and then we will give you instructions for muting and unmuting your lines during that time period. We are delighted this afternoon to have Becky Kurtz with us as the presenter. Becky is the Director of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Programs at the Administration on Aging and Administration for Community Living. And I am going to turn it right over to you, Becky, so that we can get started and have lots of time for Q&A at the end. So thanks for joining us, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Lori, and hello to everyone. I am happy that I can see the list of participants and see a lot of familiar names and names of friends out there that are on the line today. So nice to be able to talk with you all and have some discussion about the Notice for Proposed Rulemaking, or as we say in the federal government, NPRM. I wanted to start off today giving you a little bit of overview of the Ombudsman Program, which for some of you is going to be really elementary. You could give this presentation yourself, but I wanted to make sure that we have the basics of the program and its history, and then we'll move into the contents, sort of the highlights of the NPRM. Let me just say, as one other introductory piece, that because we are in a federal comment period on the NPRM, it's very important that I'm clear that all I can do today is take clarifying questions and provide clarification where possible. But I'm not going to be able to accept comments through today's conversation. The only comments that we are able to legally consider are those that are submitted in writing. And near the end of this presentation, I'll give you lots of information about how to do that. But I just wanted to make sure it's clear that when we have the Q&A session, I cannot accept any comments through today's call. I can't consider anything you say as a comment. That needs to be submitted formally. So I just wanted to be clear on that, and I will start down through the PowerPoint presentation. Except that didn't work. Let me see if this works. That works. Okay, good. So the Older Americans Act creates the Aging Network, which consists of state units on aging, area agencies on aging, and a variety of service providers and advocates for elders, and some core services among which are the Elder Rights Programs in Title VII, and one of those is the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program. The Administration on Aging, which is part of the larger now and fairly new, little over a year created, Administration for Community Living, the Administration on Aging administers the Older Americans Act. And this is a program that leverages other federal, state, and local funds and resources to deliver an array of long-term and social supports and services, and the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program is certainly an important part of that array of services. It was created in the 70s as a nursing home ombudsman program, expanded in the 80s to serve individuals in other long-term care facility settings, and since its inception, it has been a person-centered consumer protection service that has been designed to resolve problems and advocate for the rights of individuals living in long-term care facilities. There have never been regulations to fully implement the program and provide a consistent level of consumer protection across the states. And so that has resulted in challenges in some states in the implementation of this program. And we are hoping that this NPRM will address some of those challenges. It is also an elder justice service, and long-term care ombudsman programs investigate and work to resolve abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation complaints for and with consumers. In 2011, ombudsman programs worked to resolve over 18,000 abuse, neglect, and exploitation complaints, about 9% of the total complaints that year. As you may be aware, our Assistant Secretary for Aging, Kathy Greenlee, a former long-term care ombudsman from Kansas, is very committed to the cause of elder justice and to the end of elder abuse, and she sees this program and the strengthening of this program as an important part of that effort. I have here, just for reference, a few slides that include the functions of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program as required in the Older Americans Act. So I'll go through those rather quickly. Those functions include resolving complaints, informing residents of how to obtain services, providing regular and timely access to ombudsman services, seeking administrative, legal, and other remedies for residents, monitoring the development and the implementation of laws, regulations, and governmental policies and actions related to long-term care, and making recommendations for change in those laws, regulations, policies, and actions. It looks like my slide may be cut off a bit, so that should say facilitating public comments on laws, regulations, policies, and actions, promoting development of citizen organizations to participate in the program, and supporting resident and family councils. Every state has a person, one person, who is entitled as the state long-term care ombudsman with the authority to designate representatives. Some of you are in states where the programs are centralized and all employees and volunteers report directly to the state ombudsman. Others are decentralized. Frequently, those programs are housed at the local or regional or district level in area agencies on aging, and that arrangement is done through contract. Representatives of the program may be staff or they may be volunteers. Frequently the term ombudsman is used for a local staff or volunteer or regional staff or volunteer. Nationally, there are almost 1,200 staff full-time equivalents and over 9,000 certified ombudsman volunteers, as well as more than 3,000 other volunteers. The program is housed within state units on aging, elsewhere in state government, as well as within nonprofit agencies. This is at the state level, state long-term care ombudsman level. Now for a few comments about why we felt at the Administration on Aging that there was a need for rulemaking. There have been, over the last few years, a number of media reports around the need. There have also been some Inspector General reports, and there's the Older Americans Act itself specifically calls for regulations related to the conflict of interest provisions especially. We also had conducted a compliance review in one state a couple of years ago, which highlighted the difficulty of determining state compliance in carrying out some basic program requirements and addressing operational challenges that highlighted the need for regulations to be in place. Many of you on this call might be familiar with the 1995 report from the Institute of Medicine, which, though it's getting close to 20 years old now, 20 years old now, it is still very important in terms of it being the most comprehensive national evaluation of the program. And it identified a number of barriers to effective performance in the Ombudsman program. And among those, they included structural conflicts of interest that limit the ability of the program to act, and uneven implementation within and across states. Those last barriers that I mentioned are among those that we hope to address by this NPRM. In terms of rulemaking history, there are currently some regulations for the Older Americans Act Title III. Those were promulgated in 1988. And at that time, the Ombudsman Program was actually within Title III of the Older Americans Act. Those provisions related to the Ombudsman Program were within Title III. In 1992, during the reauthorization of the Older Americans Act, Title VII was created. And as a result, there was an NPRM published for Title VII regulations in 1994, by the Administration on Aging. It included, but was not limited to, regulations for the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program. However, no final rule was published at that time, so no final rule has ever been implemented. That was a comprehensive approach to regulating the Ombudsman Program. In 1988, the provisions are very limited in the current regulations. There's mention of the Ombudsman Program, but they are quite limited. In 2013, bringing us up to the present, our Assistant Secretary for Aging, Kathy Greenlee, developed this NPRM, certainly with the support of HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, seeing it as having the potential for a high-impact legacy for protecting consumers and responding to the abuse of vulnerable older adults, and with the intent of having minimal cost or burden to the implementation of the program. So the remainder of my presentation will be about the topics listed here. This is on slide 15, a table of contents, which includes state agency policies, immediate family, definition of that term, a definition of term office of the state long-term care ombudsman, definition of representatives of the office of the state long-term care ombudsman, and then provisions around the establishment of the office, around functions and responsibilities of the state ombudsman as the individual person of the state ombudsman, state agency responsibilities, that's the state unit on aging agency, and then the functions and duties of the office of the state ombudsman, as well as conflicts of interest. I read through that because I noticed there are a few more people that are on audio than are on the web, so maybe not all of you can see these slides. Let me also just say, even though these will be, assuming that they are finalized, these will be some of the most comprehensive regulations, for sure, of the Ombudsman Program, since it's very limited within the current regulations, 1988 regulations. But they are not 100% comprehensive on every topic that has ever been suggested for guidance. We made a decision to limit the regulations to those areas of greatest inconsistency and greatest need in terms of regulatory guidance to states, and try to make some priority areas, as well as to not put in regulation those things that could adequately be done through sub-regulatory guidance. In addition, if you haven't already looked at the Federal Register and seen the regulations themselves, let me just encourage you to do so and to also look at the preamble, because the preamble spends quite a bit of time and effort going through explanation of why the proposed regulations are as they are. It gives some rationale, gives some examples, and hopefully is very helpful in explaining the purpose. wanted to also give you a few terms that I'll be using throughout the NPRM discussion and that are found in the NPRM. The term ombudsman is only going to be used in the proposed rule for the individual who is the state long-term care ombudsman. That's done to reflect the way that term is used in the law in the Older Americans Act. For local, regional, or district ombudsman, whether they're staff or volunteer, the term that will be used in the NPRM is representative of the office. Again, that's to reflect the way that the Older Americans Act uses that term. Another term that is used throughout the NPRM is local ombudsman entity, and that refers to an area agency on aging or another entity, typically a nonprofit entity, that is designated by the state ombudsman to operate a local, regional, or district level ombudsman program. Okay, so now to get to the content. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about the state agency policies in the current 1988 regulation. We are proposing new language that states that the state long-term care ombudsman and his or her designee shall be responsible for monitoring the files, records, and other information maintained by the office, and shall not disclose the identity of any complainant or long-term care facility resident to individuals outside of the office, except as otherwise specifically provided, and there's a section about disclosure of information in this provision that's referenced. So the significance of this language is that it replaces current language, which permits the director of the state agency on aging and one other senior manager to review redacted files of the ombudsman program. Digital information and information obtained verbally and by other means are protected in addition to hard copies of files. So in addition, the current regulation uses only the word files. Some people might interpret that to mean hard copies of files, and we felt it was important to clarify that we're not limiting it to only files. So the term that is proposed is files, records, and other information. We know that state agencies need information to oversee ombudsman program operations and personnel and or contract management. So we invite comments to help find an appropriate balance between ombudsman protection of confidential information and state oversight responsibilities. So now to move on to the definitions that we're proposing. We propose that the term immediate family means a member of the household or a relative with whom there is a close personal or significant financial relationship. That definition is derived from the Federal Standards of Ethical Conduct. This is significant because absent a definition, this term has created uncertainty and inconsistency among states related to the scope of conflicts of interest that states must identify and remove. And we believe that it describes relationships that could impair the judgment of an ombudsman or give the appearance of bias. In the Older Americans Act, this term, immediate family, applies in three areas, all related to conflicts of interest. It's related to any individual who designates the state ombudsman, the state ombudsman himself or herself, as well as representatives of the office. Now for the definition of office of the state long-term care ombudsman. The definition we propose is that it be the organizational unit headed by the state long-term care ombudsman and including the representatives of the office. The Older Americans Act indicates that the office shall be headed by an individual to be known as the state long-term care ombudsman, and indicates that the state ombudsman has the responsibility for designating local ombudsman entities as well as employees and/or volunteers who serve as representatives of the office. As a result of those provisions in the Older Americans Act, we feel that and have proposed that it is the state ombudsman and his or her representatives that constitute the office. This is significant because throughout the Older Americans Act, there are a number of determinations mentioned, and those determinations are to be made by the office. So it's important to know who do we mean by the office. And there have been a variety of interpretations. Sometimes people have found that the office is the state ombudsman and representatives of that office. Others have found that it should be the state agency, or have interpreted it to mean that it's the state agency on aging. And there's been a lack of clarification on that. So we have found, we propose this following definition. And the significance is that where the Act says the state agency, for example, shall require the office to recommend any changes in laws, regulations, and policies as the office determines to be appropriate, that in fact means the state ombudsman as well as representatives of the office under the leadership of the state ombudsman. Moving on to the next definition, representatives of the office. We propose that means the employees or volunteers designated by the ombudsman to fulfill the duties set forth in another provision, whether supervised by the ombudsman or by his or her designees or by a local entity designated by the ombudsman. Again, we are proposing this because we believe the Act is unclear whether the representatives of the office are to represent the office or to represent the local ombudsman entity. And it is our hope that this clarifies that the representatives of the office, including local staff and volunteers designated by the ombudsman, in fact do represent the office. This is significant because it means that the representatives of the office are to be held accountable to the head of the office, the state long-term care ombudsman, for purposes of program operations. Now moving on to the establishment of the office provisions. It's our intent to clarify through this NPRM which determinations are the responsibility of the state long-term care ombudsman, and to clarify that such determinations are those of the office but do not represent other state governmental entities. Since these determinations are frequently outside the scope of the authority of most state employees, and since many, not all, but many state ombudsmen are state employees, we believe that this clarification will assist states in full implementation of the Act. This is significant because the office is expected to make determinations as required by the Older Americans Act, and those include recommendations to changes in laws, regulations, policies, and actions pertaining to residents, determinations regarding disclosure of resident or complainant information maintained by the program, as well as determinations regarding the provision of information to public and private agencies, legislators, and other persons regarding the problems and concerns of residents and recommendations related to those problems and concerns. Regarding the functions and responsibilities of the state long-term care ombudsman, again, this is regarding the individual who is the state long-term care ombudsman. We clarify the appropriate role and responsibilities of the ombudsman within the NPRM as the head of the office. And some of those provisions include oversight of a unified statewide program, designation as well as de-designation of representatives of the office, involvement in area plan reviews and monitoring of local ombudsman entities where that applies. Certainly in a centralized model, you wouldn't need to do this, but in a decentralized model, those area plan reviews and monitoring functions would be relevant. Management and disclosure of ombudsman program information. Proposal of ombudsman program policies, procedures, and standards. Leadership of statewide systems advocacy efforts of the office. Determining the use of the fiscal resources of the office. Development and approval of an annual report. Coordination with entities responsible for the protection of vulnerable adults. And the list continues. I think I just skipped one. No, the list doesn't continue. I apologize. I thought there was another slide in there. So that's the list of the functions and responsibilities. And now on to 23. Slide 23, the state agency responsibilities related to the ombudsman program. The state agency must establish the policies and procedures which enable the ombudsman program to operate in accordance with the Act. And that includes provisions for the ombudsman to provide leadership of the office, including the provisions we just reviewed. And it also has a provision that requires the state agency to coordinate Title VII programs and other entities responsible for the protection of vulnerable adults. There are a couple things in this provision that I wanted to draw your attention to in terms of significance. The state is to exclude the ombudsman program from state mandatory abuse reporting requirements in these provisions. Later in the rule, we indicate when reporting is appropriate, but it is our expectation through this proposal that states would, in accepting the grant to operate a long-term care ombudsman program, that states would provide that ombudsman programs are not mandatory abuse reporters. Another significant part of this provision is that states are to exclude the ombudsman and representatives of the office from any state lobbying prohibitions that might be inconsistent with the Act. The next provision relates to functions and duties of the office. And this section includes guidance on the duties of representatives of the office, or as some of you refer to them, as local, regional, or district ombudsman. It proposes a number of things, but one of the most important relate to complaint processing. And we spend quite a bit of time describing in the complaint processing what to do when an individual resident is unable to communicate his or her wishes. As those of you who are ombudsmen certainly know, there are lots of situations where residents can tell you what they want, and that gives clear guidance to the ombudsman on how to proceed. There are lots of other situations where the resident is unable to communicate any consent or to tell you what their wishes are, and they may not have a representative able to do that, and so then what do you do? We propose guidance around how to serve residents when they are unable to consent and have no one to do that on their behalf, including in abuse situations. We also provide guidance about the responsibility of the office when a representative of the office personally observes abuse, and we provide provisions for when it is appropriate to reveal the identity of a resident when you have been unable to secure their permission. And then finally, we have provisions around conflicts of interest. And there's two different kinds of conflicts of interest we're addressing here. One is the organizational placement of the office, and then we'll get on to individual conflicts of interest. So first we start off with examples of what constitute organizational conflicts of interest. Most of these examples come from the Institute of Medicine report that I mentioned earlier, And I would encourage you, if you haven't already, if you're interested in understanding more about this issue, to take a look at that report. It has a whole chapter on conflict of interest that provides lots of examples and explanation about why most of these examples are considered conflicts of interest. But the bottom line is, these are situations where a resident may ask an ombudsman to work on resolution of a complaint about one of these functions. And the ombudsman needs to be able to, without any conflict of interest, investigate and work to resolve these complaints. So the examples include an organization that is responsible for licensing or certifying long-term care facilities, an association of long-term care facilities, has ownership or investment interest in or receives grants or donations from a long-term care facility, has governing board members with ownership, investment, or employment interest in long-term care facilities, provides long-term care services, provides long-term care coordination or case management, sets reimbursement rates for long-term care services, and continuing on to slide 26, provides adult protective services, is responsible for Medicaid eligibility determinations, conducts pre-admission screening for long-term care residential placements, makes decisions regarding admission or discharge of individuals to or from long-term care facilities, provides guardianship, conservatorship, or other fiduciary services for residents. So if one of those examples exists, what does an entity do? Well, we are requiring proposing that the requirement be that states have a process in place for identifying and removing or remedying organizational conflicts between the office and the organization in which it is located. And we propose that the state ombudsman have a process to identify and remove or remedy conflicts within local ombudsman entities. States must assure that ombudsman disclosure in the National Ombudsman Reporting System is made, and that include organizational conflicts of interest of the office, as well as steps taken to remedy or remove those conflicts. So basically, we would be asking the state ombudsman to add one additional question to NORS that would describe the conflicts and the steps taken to remedy or remove them. Again, this is our proposal of how to approach this. We recognize that some states and local ombudsman entities face significant challenges in removing or remedying some of these organizational conflicts of interest. And we seek your comments on the anticipated impact of this proposal and possible solutions. So now on to the conflicts of interest individual examples. We are proposing that an ombudsman, representatives of the office, or members of their immediate family have a conflict of interest if they have direct involvement in licensing or certification of a facility or provider, have ownership or investment interest in a long-term care facility or service, have the right to receive remuneration from a long-term care facility, accept gifts or gratuities from a long-term care facility, resident or resident representatives, accept money from anyone other than the office for the performance of duties of the office without ombudsman approval. And the examples continue. Serve as a guardian or other fiduciary for a resident in the service area. Serve residents for a facility in which an immediate family member resides. Participate in activities which negatively impact on the ability of the office to serve residents or create a perception that the primary interest of the office is other than as a resident advocate. Or were employed by a long-term care facility in the service area within the previous year. We certainly know that a lot of states already have provisions like this, some even more stringent than these examples in place, but we want to propose these as a baseline. We seek comments on approaches that both promote the integrity of the program without disqualifying excellent candidates, knowing that there are certainly excellent candidates that have come through the pipeline that may have some of these proposed examples of conflicts, but we seek your comments on finding the right balance. So the next steps in the rulemaking process, here is the link to the NPRM, and the public comments are accepted until August 19th. Comments are going to be then reviewed by us. Certainly we'll revise the proposed rules as needed. And then we will go through a clearance process both within Health and Human Services as well as the White House Office of Management and Budget, also known as OMB, before publishing a final rule as well as responses to comments in the Federal Register. The NPRM proposes that there is an effective date 1 year after the final rule is published. Our thinking is that it would give time for states and local ombudsman entities to make any needed changes in laws, policies, or structures that might need to happen as a result of the final rule. And we certainly intend to provide technical assistance to support states and state long-term care ombudsmen and local ombudsman entities to come into compliance. So we certainly want to provide a lot of assistance to help states succeed and local ombudsman entities succeed in complying with the rule once it's finalized. And then my last slide is information on how to submit your comments. We strongly prefer comments to be submitted electronically through regulations.gov. Comments can be provided by mail, and I have the address here of how to submit comments by mail, as well as by express mail or by hand delivery. Let me say, however, that if you're going to send it by first-class mail, please know that sometimes our mail, because it has to go through a screening process, takes several weeks to get to us. So we cannot accept and cannot read any or cannot consider, I should say, any comments that are received after August 19th. So the best way to avoid a problem is to submit those through regulations.gov. So I think we have about 20 minutes for Q&A, and I will turn it back over to the conference organizers to go through the Q&A with me. I know there have been several questions coming through chat, and I know there may be some verbally over the phone as well, and I'll let you all moderate that and tell me how you'd like me to handle the Q&A.
Okay, great. Thanks, Becky, and thanks for your very informative and thorough presentation. So we will move into questions and answers right now, and as was mentioned earlier, you can submit a question either by typing it into the chat feature in the bottom left corner of your screen, or by clicking to raise your hand, at which point we will call on you and give you instructions on how to unmute your line so that you can ask the question verbally to Becky. So as was mentioned, there are a number that have started coming in through the chat feature, and why don't we start with a first one. Mary Beth, can you read one out for us?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
And I can too.
Okay, great. Kathy Bradley wanted to know if there was a PDF of the preamble and proposed regulations that individuals could download.
I always go online to look at it, so I'm not sure if there's a PDF version of that or not. We certainly have a PDF version of the document that we submitted to the Federal Register. It's not in that format, and we can share that with the Resource Center if you want to get that out.
Okay. That would be great, Becky. And I think we also have the PDF of the when it was up for observation the day before.
Oh, good. So that would be the same document I would send you. So if that, I don't have a change to that. So if you want to just send that out, that would be fine.
We will, and we'll post it to the Consumer Voice and Ombudsman Resource Center websites afterwards so that you can see it there.
So I think the only change would be that that version did not include in it the deadline for comments. I think that was the only thing added, was the August 19th date.
Okay. So, Mary Beth, the next question.
Okay, great. The next question comes from Mark Miller. He asked, does designation and de-designation of representatives include designating a de-designating local entity or entities?
So the question is, while the federal law gives the designation authority, do we specifically address the de-designation authority? Yes. I'm looking up the provision. In proposed provision 1327.13(c), it says, the ombudsman shall determine designation and de-designation of local ombudsman entities and representatives of the office.
Great. Thank you so much. Our next question comes from Neil Garreau. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. He asks, slide number 24 cites resident inability to express, what does the ombudsman do in that situation? So I think this is about ombudsman program responsibility when the resident is unable to communicate his or her wishes.
Right. Well, first of all, let me encourage you to read that entire provision because it's rather lengthy, and there are a lot of if this, then this, and if this, then this. But the short version is that if a resident is unable to communicate his or her informed consent or perspectives, that and there is no guardian or other legal representative able to act on the individual's behalf, that the representative of the office, so you may use the term local ombudsman colloquially, but representatives of the office, if that individual has reason to believe that the identification of the resident would be in the best interest of the resident, they can then submit that situation to the state ombudsman for approval and reveal the identity of that individual with state ombudsman approval. So there are provisions for revealing the identity of the resident when it's in the best interest of the resident and the resident cannot provide consent with approval of the state ombudsman. It's a little bit similar. Those of you who know the federal Build Americans Act well know that there's a provision for obtaining access to records when there's a guardian, but the guardian is not acting in the best interests of the resident, and the local ombudsman gets approval from the state ombudsman. And so it's a similar kind of process where whether the legal representative is not acting in the best interest or if there is no legal representative, but the situation calls for the best interest of the resident to reveal the identity, then there's a process for getting approval by the ombudsman to reveal the identity. I hope that's clear enough. I really encourage you to read those provisions, though, because there's a couple of different scenarios that are laid out about how that process could work.
Thanks, Becky.
Okay. Our next question comes from Marie Peterson, who asks, our AAA provides homemaker services, respite services, and case management. Is this a conflict of interest?
So the provision of services within a long-term care facility that the where the ombudsman serves the residents would likely be the proposed conflict of interest here. So while I can't go through and say, yes, this is it, and no, that's not it, the idea is that if services are being provided to residents and ombudsmen are serving those residents, then the idea is that the ombudsman may be called on to investigate complaints about that service. So I hope that's clear enough. I mean, we're not going to be able here to look at each individual situation and say, yes, that's in, yes, that's out, as an example. But even if you identify that there is a conflict, then the question is, well, what do you do about it? So you identify it, and then you talk about, well, what are the steps that need to be taken so that residents have confidence in the ombudsman's ability to resolve their complaint, and so that there is no interference with the ombudsman work or any conflict in terms of the ombudsman work being able to completely be focused on resolving the problem for the resident. That's what we're really getting at here. I hope that was responsive. I don't know if there's a follow-up question to that, but
We have not received one at this time, so let's just move on to the next question. It comes from David Hoffman, who asks, since representatives of the office include everyone serving as a long-term care ombudsman, state, local employees, and volunteers, is it your position that all of these individuals have immunity from suit when performing their functions?
The immunity question is actually not addressed by the proposed regulations. What the Older Americans Act does is it requires states to provide for immunity in certain situations. And so while it's not addressed specifically in the regulations, the immunity discussion, you can find a provision in the Older Americans Act that is already there that says it's a requirement that the state shall ensure that no representative of the office will be liable under state law for the good faith performance of official duties. So I think that language probably already addresses the question in the law. We did not include that specific language in the proposed regulation.
Okay, great. Thank you. Our next question comes from Gail Simon, who asks, since resident and family councils provide direct stakeholder care concerns, will suggestions be considered by these groups?
Comments are considered by anybody, any group, any individual, anybody at all, and we strongly encourage your comments. And I should add another thing about comments, and that is that this is one of those things about federal law and how regulations work in federal law. We cannot add or subtract to the comments that we've, to the proposed rule without a comment to justify it. So we need to have a comment about a topic in order to add a rule about a proposal about it. And similarly, if we have proposed something that someone feels we should omit, that we should not have in there, we would need a comment about that in order to justify that change. So anything that you see that you have a difference of opinion on or feel like needs to get strengthened or changed or added or subtracted, please don't hesitate to comment. It will help us as we understand how all of you feel these will work or not work, and it will help us in terms of knowing what we may need to add or subtract. But we can't do that without comments in the final rule. So we really need your comments and really appreciate any efforts any of you put in to submitting comments to us.
Okay, great. The next question comes from Margaret, who asks, why is there not proposed regulations on the selection of the state ombudsman, including the de-designation of the state ombudsman?
The state ombudsman designation provision is related to the state agency responsibilities. And so in the Older Americans Act, it indicates that the state agency has a responsibility for designating that individual or for having it in place. The only things that the Older Americans Act talks about specifically about designation of the state ombudsman relate to the, well, two things. It says in it that the office shall be headed by an individual who shall be selected from among individuals with expertise and experience in the fields of long-term care and advocacy. And then the other piece is about the individual who designates the ombudsman has to be free from conflict of interest. So those are the provisions that are in the Act about the designation. I think that I'm trying to think if there was any mention of that designation duty here. I don't think so, other than under the conflict of interest provisions. So, I think the answer to your question is that we were following the Act provisions about designation of the representatives of the office when we were going through the powers of the state ombudsman, but that the state agency responsibilities we did not expand beyond what's in the Older Americans Act.
Thank you. Moving on to the next question, who comes from Brian Lee, who asks, how about proposing a definition for independence? This would reinforce the program's autonomy and provide a baseline for states to address and remedy potential interference and conflict.
Since that was sort of a comment, I just want to reiterate what I said at the beginning, which is that we need your comments to be submitted in writing and cannot accept comments through this Q&A time. So please submit that comment in writing if it's a suggestion for us to consider.
Okay.
And I guess I should say that about the previous one, about the designation of the state ombudsman. If that's something folks feel like we should consider, we invite that comment.
All right. Thank you so much. The next question comes from Gail again, who is asking, just to clarify the definition of immediate family, this is for a conflict of interest and not to be confused with advocating on behalf of a resident, say, through a family council.
Yes, the definition of immediate family it says pertaining to conflicts of interest as used in Section 712 of the Act. So it's very specific to conflict of interest provisions only, not to who can an ombudsman serve.
All right. The next question comes from Anise McLemore, who asks, when both the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program and APS are organizationally linked to and housed within the SUA, is this a conflict of interest?
The proposed rule is that an example of a conflict of interest organizationally would be that the same entity houses the Ombudsman Program as well as Adult Protective Services. And then, as I mentioned before, the next step would be, if that is identified as a conflict, what steps can be taken to remedy or remove that conflict. And certainly, about half of the state units on aging, I believe, house the Adult Protective Services function. So we certainly, and a number of these other functions, there are a number of other functions on this list that many state units on aging house. And so we certainly will be providing support to states, assuming that that becomes a final rule. We'll certainly be providing support to states of excellent practices in how to remedy those kinds of conflicts so that ombudsman can fully operate and represent interests of residents and APS can fully do their job, but yet they are completely separated out so that that there would not be any interference with the ombudsman work on behalf of residents.
Thanks, Becky. We do have a hand raised, Margaret Higgins. If you can press *7 on your phone, it will unmute you and you can ask Becky your question.
Hi, Becky.
Hello.
With the change of the wordage, what would the long-term care ombudsman coordinator be called, or will there not be such a thing?
Do you mean by change of the wordage, you mean the term representatives of the office?
Correct.
So all we're actually not proposing any change of wordage. That language is actually taken directly from the Older Americans Act as it exists now. So we were just keeping those terms consistent. How your state chooses to use terms like coordinator or regional director or any terms your state chooses to use, it won't necessarily have to change. I only wanted to make clear who I was referring to in the regulation, in the proposed regulation, because we use the terms that are in the Act, and I know those are not always the terms that states use on the ground. So there's not a change being proposed.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right.
Thank you. And you can press *6 to remute your line. Thanks. Mary Beth, next.
All right, great, thank you. Our next question comes from Janet Brennan, who asks, will the NPRM address ombudsman access to records in reference to complaints regarding community-based long-term care?
I'm going to assume that this question is asking about access to serve residents and see their records in settings other than facilities, like in people's homes. So let me know if I'm not understanding that question. In terms of services to people in settings other than long-term care facilities as defined by the Older Americans Act, the NPRM does not have any provisions related to those services. The reason is because the Older Americans Act specifically defines long-term care ombudsman services as services for residents who live in long-term care facilities, and those are defined as nursing homes, assisted living, board and care, and other similar adult care facilities. States, I think 12 states plus Washington, D.C., have chosen to expand the service to other settings, and that's a state expansion, but not an Older Americans Act expansion. We can only publish regulations that specifically relate back to the authority in the Older Americans Act. So without that federal authority, we cannot issue regulations related to services in settings other than those facilities specifically set forth in the Older Americans Act. So that was a long way of saying if you're asking about in-home services, the answer is no.
Thanks, Becky. Well, I have by my clock that we are just about at the top of the hour, and I know that there were one or two more questions that we were not able to get to, but maybe folks can, if they are specific questions, we can pass them on to you, Becky.
Sure, that'd be fine.
Okay. Just a reminder to the participants today that today's webinar recording and PowerPoint will be made available within the next couple of days through the Consumer Voice and Ombudsman Center websites. I would encourage you to take the time to read the preamble to the regulations because it contains excellent language about what AOA's intent was for writing the regulatory language the way they did, and provides a lot of insight into that. A reminder also that comments are due by August 19th, 5 p.m. Eastern Time, as Becky mentioned earlier. I'd like to thank you all for participating in today's webinar, and particularly to Becky, who I know you've been doing this presentation a lot lately, and know that it's very much appreciated that you took the time out this afternoon to do it for us as well. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks to all who participated.
And with that, we're going to close the webinar this afternoon and look for the postings on the website, and have a good rest of the day. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Please stand by.